Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Seeking Justice on Blog Talk Radio. My name is Denny Griffin. For the next 60 minutes, my co-host Kim Colton and I will be seeking justice for Joshua Whittier. And Kim, thanks for being here.
Well, thank you, Denny. It's nice to be here.
And I'm excited about our debut.
Yes, me too. Oh, this is it's going to be a good show.
Okay, we'll get started. We have some very special guests tonight, and I will introduce them. First of all, we're going to be discussing a case of Joshua Whittier. And Joshua was found deceased on a beach in Santa Rosa County, Florida, in February 18th of 2007. And joining us tonight is Josh's mom, Melody Schmidt. Melody, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
And in the interest of disclosure, I've been acquainted with Melody, since last year in 2007, and 2008, and she was actually on a previous Blog Talk Radio show of mine in May of 2008. And it's great to have you back with me again. And also with us is investigative reporter from the Reality News Network, David Craig. And David is also covered the Joshua Whittier story. David, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
And David was also on the show in May of 2008. And we have well-known private detective Vito Colucci Jr. with us also. Vito, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Denny, very much. My pleasure.
And Vito runs a former Stamford, Connecticut police officer, detective, now a highly successful private investigator out of Connecticut, works some very high-profile cases, and he is also a new author. And his book is Inside the Private Eyes of a PI, and I finished reading it a couple of weeks ago, and it's a great read. Vito, congratulations on your book.
Thank you, Denny. It's one of those things in life that's really a fun project, you know, as you know very well.
Yes. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Before we start, I'd like to mention that I did inform the Santa Rosa County, Florida Sheriff's Office that we were going to be doing this program tonight. So it's possible that someone from there will be listening in. And if they have any comments or responses to anything that's said here, certainly they're welcome to call in. And if not, Melody, I assume they know how to get a hold of you if they wanted to touch base with you about anything?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. What I'd like to do to get started, Melody, if you could take the listeners from February 18th, 2007, and what happened to you on that day regarding Josh, and what you did or what you went through up until last May of 2008, when we first talked on my radio show. Would you do that for us?
Yes. Well, when we got the news that Josh had died, I just accepted he drank too much on his birthday, celebrating his 21st birthday, and started the grieving process. Within about a week or two, I called the medical examiner, though, and I was asking her questions of terminology to understand her records, the things she had stated, and she told me she thought there was foul play. When she said that to me, then my antennas went up, and I started asking more questions and researching a little more and talking to more people, and as time went on, it was just becoming more and more obvious that Josh didn't drown. Something else had happened. And so I just kept asking questions and learning a lot along the way. Was on your show. Put together two websites these wonderful people have helped I've met so many people along the way that have helped with so many different things. You just don't know how to handle all of this. But continuing to just push and ask questions and just a lot of things have transpired. I've talked to a lot of people. They closed the case. You know, I don't even remember dates at this point, Denny. So much has happened. But I did do a protest on the beach a couple months after Josh had died, you know, saying we believe he was murdered, that there's something more to this and we're not getting a fair investigation. State attorney got involved, and I put together a list of requests, which they've handled, but questioning me, not understanding why would I want phone records of the people that were with my son that night, things like that. Eventually, I just didn't feel like I was getting anywhere. I found out where the governor was going to be at a school, and I held signs there, and he stopped and spoke with me, set up an appointment with me, and then he canceled it. And I ended up sending them three other family stories of problems in that area, of things we were frustrated with and investigations not getting handled correctly. And 3 weeks later, I got a call from his assistant saying there's not enough information, they can't help us. Well, nobody was ever called to ask for any more information. I thought, we're just not getting help here. And through networking and networking and networking and people helping and not quitting, I now have a high-profile investigative team working on Josh's case, so I am kind of limited tonight what I can share. But we do have things moving forward. At this point, we are going to be requesting soon that they change the ruling on Josh's case to undetermined rather than accidental drowning. Many people that were interviewed stated they believe Josh fell off the pier. Well, he wouldn't have sustained such injuries on his hands, et cetera, had that happened. The pier was not high enough, and the tides do not coincide at all where Josh's body was found. And if you look at the websites, too, it's got a lot of information on there of the different things that just don't add up. Gosh, I think that...
So it was the state attorney general that told you you needed to give them more evidence?
Nobody's really said I need to get – well, actually, last week I called the sheriff's office to see if the case was closed, because I have left them alone since last July to let them do their work. And a man said, the case is inactive, but it is not closed. And then I talked to another gentleman, and he said next week they would be putting together records of Sergeant Leo's research he's done of things that I requested.
Melody,
don't have yes.
Oh, before I move on to David, what is the name of that website?
There's two of them. There's two websites: realcrimes.com, and it's alphabetical, so you scroll to the end. Joshua Whittier, and the other one is AmericaIsWatching.org, and also Joshua Whittier.
Okay, now. David, let me ask you how you first got involved and how you met Melody, and what was your take on the situation in the beginning, and possibly how did that all change?
Melody, correct me if I'm wrong. Didn't you call me a few months after your son's death, and was it you who contacted me and asked me to get involved? Is that correct?
You know, I'm not even sure, David. I had so many people pointing me to different people. I've talked to so many people in the last 2.5 years. Actually, I'm thinking maybe so. They said, yeah, you need to talk to David Craig.
That's my best recollection, that Melody called me. You know, we are talking 2.5 years ago. Let me give you another website, too, realitynews.net.
Sure.
Reality, like things that are real, realitynews.net. And all of the reports that I did, and, you know, if you wanted to follow at least, you know, my thinking throughout the investigation, you know, it's available there. The Joshua Whittier files are right on the front page there. The other references, the sites she gave, are also very good. Let me start with the case was closed. when Melody contacted me. It was about 3 months after his death. And the ruling of the medical examiner specifically was cause of death, drowning, and manner of death, accidental, with a caveat. It was accidental unless more information surfaces to indicate otherwise. Now, given that ruling, one would think that the Santa Rosa Sheriff's Office might consider holding on to the evidence that they had collected, his clothing, a wallet, etc. And yet they gave it to a family friend. They closed the case, gave the evidence away, which, you know, certainly tainted the evidence. And that was kind of surprising to me, given the nature of the ruling. So I got into this really with no preconceived notion, but I thought I would look at the theory of the state, you know, which was accidental drowning, and see if what I could determine would tend to sustain that conclusion. And I asked Melody if she would allow the family friend to give up the evidence to my custody. And mm-hmm. she did. I drove out to Navarre and picked up the evidence in several bags. My impression is, and what I was told by the friend from which I got it, is it hadn't been disturbed at all from the time it was given to this person, and I picked it up shortly thereafter. And a couple of things I noted that were a little surprising was, one is that Joshua's cell phone, which was, it was stated in one of the reports that the cell phone had been in his jacket pocket, so the cell phone worked fine. And there was actually no reference to the cell phone being checked by the sheriff's office or anybody, you know, listening to messages on it or anything like that. And another really disturbing thing was I saw very clear set blood stains on his pants. And Joshua was a model by profession, a Ford model. And, you know, his pants were most certainly clean the night he went out on his birthday. And yet, you know, the pants I saw had blood stains on them. Now, the blood stains were not referred to in any way or examined by either the sheriff's office or the medical examiner. There was just no mention of blood-stained pants. So I thought that was, you know, a bit of an oversight. I did meet with the sheriff's office after preparing a first story that was going to air on regional TV, and, you know, talked to them about it and, you know, about my findings and my thoughts. And essentially the reception I got was they really didn't want me to go ahead with the story. You know, I didn't think they were really giving a fair hearing to my concerns. When I brought up the question, you know, well, what about the blood on the pants? The response mm-hmm. I got was, what blood? And it was genuine surprise. The detective I was talking to really was not aware of the blood. I mean, I'm sure of that. And he was also a little accusatory, as though, well, you know, did I put some blood on the pants? Well, I can assure you I didn't. And there's just some quick conclusions which led me to the my theory that Joshua was definitely murdered on that beach. People don't generally bleed when they drown, but if they do, the blood is washed away. There were experiments done by Jan Johnson, who's a blood expert. She had a lot of time with the Florida Department of Law Enforcement and the FBI, and they actually tested blood stains on pants, the same type of pants, in salt water, and essentially the blood would have washed away if it had been in the water for any length of time. Fresh blood would. And yet these are set stains. Also, from her report, she's certain and that most of the blood came from the outside of the garment. And there really aren't any wounds on Joshua that are consistent with bleeding. So what my theory is that there was a fight that occurred up the beach a little ways, and Joshua was bleeding from his nose and at least his blood, if not possibly others, but at least his blood had settled on his pants. And there was some period of time between the fight and when I believe he was dragged to his death by both legs, and I hope you'll pardon me, Melody, for being so direct here, probably by two persons. Joshua was a big guy. He was strong. He had just finished working a construction job, and he had symmetrical injuries on his body, both hands, the palms of which were completely scraped, and the tips of his fingers, the skin was completely scraped off. His fingernails were jagged, and essentially it looked like a person who had been grappling for purchase in the sand. And by the way, it's not just smooth sand on that beach. It's rocks and shells. While he was being dragged to his drowning death at the shoreline, I don't argue with the conclusion that he may have been drowned. But as we know, nature doesn't often offer symmetrical injuries, and Joshua had symmetrical injuries on his body. They weren't well explained. There were also some scrape marks on his forearms that were along the length of his forearms and would tend to, you know, comport with my theory of being dragged by his feet to the shoreline. His clothing, his shirt and his jacket, and the beads he was wearing, Mardi Gras beads, had all ridden up and were covering his face and over his head, which is also consistent with being dragged by his feet. On one of the photos, and I had the evidence photos, I can see a line, an indentation visible in the sand on the crime scene photos that points directly to Joshua's body on the beach. And I can see where they dragged him to his drowning death at the shoreline. I don't believe that there ever was any look at the tide charts or any attempt to establish a time of death, because neither tide nor time of death was referenced in any of the documents I saw given up by the police. But I believe he was murdered between 2 and 3 a.m. based upon the tide charts I found. The water was coming back up the next day. The tide was going out that early morning. And Joshua's body was found in the early morning and before the water had returned and actually, you know, reached his body again. But finally, David Singstock, who is one of a few people who are very persons of interest anyway in this case, and he's the stepbrother or half-brother of Ricky Clark? Sorry, it's
yes.
Been a while. Okay. David Singstock called me right after that TV report. And by the way, he was seen walking out to the beach 1:30 a.m. in the morning shortly before, you know, Joshua, you know, left this earth. And David called me, David Singstock. He told me that he knew that Joshua was murdered, but that he didn't do it. And I'd just like to add and by the way, his emotions were very unusual. If I were accused of murdering a person I knew or a friend of mine, and I hadn't committed that murder, personally, I'd be angry. But Davy Singstock, when he called me, was very matter-of-fact and just conversational, almost, you know, friendly and kind of laid back and just, hey, by the way, you know, I know he was murdered, but I didn't do it. I found his emotions very unusual. Finally, Joshua had been drinking that night. Prior to his death, he did have some use of cocaine, as was proven by a blood test. But he was certainly capable of walking, talking, and making phone calls at 1:30 a.m. when he exited the north door of Juana's pagodas into temperatures of 30 degrees. It's quite unlikely that he decided to go for a swim. If he fell in the water, he would have simply, and no doubt quickly, gotten out. An independent medical examiner opinion that I got based upon the level of cocaine and alcohol in his system was that it would not have impaired his ability to exit the water if he fell in. The water there, by the way, is very shallow, and it's remained shallow for a while, even if one is walking out, you know, toward the center of the body of the water. It's going to be shallow, very shallow for a long time. Finally, the medical examiner, based upon the cocaine and alcohol in his system, and this is the independent opinion I got from a Dr. Berkland, he told me that if people would drown with that level of alcohol and cocaine in their system, then we would be picking up dozens of bodies from all of the beaches of Florida every single day of the year. So eyewitnesses put people who swore they were not with Joshua at that time, eyewitnesses put them on the beach. I think there was very little attempt to look at this at a homicide up front. And, Vito, you're a former police officer, and, you know, you'll be, I'm sure, the first to agree that all deaths should be looked at as a homicide. Mm-hmm. And otherwise you're going to miss a lot of murders. And they went into this as an accidental drowning, and then when evidence began to mount that it was something else, they ignored it. And then it was actually May of last year that Melody and I met with the Santa Rosa Sheriff, Wendell Hall, and he agreed to open the case. So he reopened the case that had been closed 3 months after the death. And that's really where we're at now. I don't think too much progress has been made.
Can I mention a couple of things?
Sure.
Ricky Clark is now in prison for threatening his pregnant girlfriend's life. I emailed Ricky and I said, Ricky, I wanted to let you know, Josh called me a couple weeks before he died and he said, Mom, I'm doing recreational drugs and I need to quit. Can I come start staying at your house on the weekends? I said, yeah. That's fine, Josh. Do we need to put you in rehab or anything? He said, no, Mom, I just need to get away from this stuff on the weekends. But I want to stay around my friends because I want to help them find salvation and get saved with the Lord. I said, okay, Josh, just make sure you're okay. Well, I emailed all of this to Ricky, and his response was, why do you keep saying that? I wasn't there that night, which I didn't mention that at all. And within a week's time, his girlfriend had been beaten up, and they pressed charges, and he is now in prison for, I think it's a year and 9 months and 9 days.
Ricky Clark and Davey Singstock were both seen going out to the beach at 1:30 in the morning, where Joshua was known to be in the 30-degree temperatures prior to his death, you know, by eyewitness Michelle Powell.
Yes, and I've talked to a couple of individuals in the last couple months, and one of them was the girlfriend, and she said, yes, I even talked to an individual, and he said he met somebody on the beach, and they were telling him that they sat there and watched the whole thing happen. Well, I know who this person is, so it's just a matter of time before we get the questioning going, but it's putting the puzzle pieces together ourselves because we haven't been getting the help, but I do have the help now coming in, and also another thing I wanted to comment on was I talked to another individual. Ricky supposedly told this person everything that happened. And I spoke to this person, and he told me that Josh had gotten hit in the head from behind with a board. And I kept thinking, I've seen a picture of that. I've seen a picture of the board. And there is a picture in one of the newspaper articles. There's a board laying there. Mm-hmm. So, again, we're still putting pieces together. But it's coming together.
Yeah, and let me just go one layer further here. A newspaper delivery person, and actually there were two of them together, but only one of them was able to make the ID, that came pretty much almost at first light or just before first light, saw, and I believe it was Davey Singstock was ID'd by that person, but with a companion who may have been Ricky Clark, and saw them exiting the beach later that morning. So we have two eyewitnesses that put Davey Singstock on the beach, and one of them that puts both Ricky and Davey on the beach, both of them swore they hadn't been there. There's also a Sean Siprit, who is the brother of a Santa Rosa County Sheriff's deputy, and he by statements that he made to the sheriff's office compared with phone records, clearly lied. There's no other possible explanation. He said that he'd been called by Joshua and asked to come fetch him and give him a ride at one point because Joshua was so drunk, and yet phone records indicate that actually this Sean Siprit subject had called Joshua at least three times that evening, but there was, you know, no record in that time frame of a call from Joshua to him. And there, Joshua, to confuse matters further, made 79 calls, made and received 79 calls that day, you know, beginning with first thing in the morning and up to the last call he received. And the sheriff's office spoke to 14 people that Joshua had contact with, either by phone or most of them in person during the course of the day. And based upon statements that they made and based and compared to phone records or statements that others of their companions made, if one compares those, it seemed to me like every single one of them was lying about something. I mean, almost mm-hmm. all of them, with the possible mm-hmm. exception of his girlfriend. And I kind of wondered that since it was presented to them, my understanding it was this matter was presented to them as an unfortunate drowning of their friend, why everybody was lying about this. There's also another person who almost immediately was committed to a mental institution after this, a Christopher Patton, who I believe he made the statement to the police that Ricky had told him that he had murdered Joshua. Is that correct, Melody?
I know for about the first week after Josh died, he kept walking around saying, I'm going to kill Ricky. Ricky killed Josh. I'm going to kill him. I'm going to kill Ricky. And then within a day of Josh's death, he was put in the mental ward. And they're saying, oh, he's unreliable. Well, I think he watched the whole thing and he's a wreck from it because that was his best friend.
Oh, there was a Michael Day who said that he had been told that. Was it Christopher who told him, or was it Michael Day who said that Ricky had told him that Ricky had killed
Joshua?
It
was Ricky. Ricky had told Michael.
Ricky had told Michael Day. Okay. So there were at least a couple of people floating around who were saying he was murdered. One of the people who eyewitnesses put on the beach with him, you know, called me up and said he knows he was murdered, Joshua, but that you know, that he didn't do it. Again, I'm referring to Davy Singstock. Vito, does this sound like an accidental drowning to you?
No, not at all, David. Not at all. I've been listening to you here, and I want to say one thing. I deal with investigative reporters and media on a daily basis. Had a big powwow with a investigative reporter today in one of my cases, and I have to tell you, I admire your work. Not trying to build you up. I have been listening to you. I think the family is very fortunate, Melody,
to
have somebody. Trust me, I do this. I've been doing this for 21 years, and I was a detective on the police department before that. And you don't see the type of guys like David come down the pike every day. So with the stuff he's been doing on this and adding to it is a tremendous, tremendous help. But, you know, David, what's amazing, I have one question for you. This area, this community, this, what do you call it, Navarre Beach? Is that how it's pronounced?
Navarre.
Okay. Is this like a high-end, is this kind of a place where there's usually no crime and it's a nice type of a getaway from some people? Is this what this place is or no?
I would call it that. It's usually that way. You know, when there is a problem there, it's usually a big problem. But normally, you know, it's an upper middle class or, frankly, an upper class getaway.
Okay. And as far as the police department, sheriff's office, whatever it is, in this jurisdiction that would handle crime in that county, do they get a lot of these type of cases? I'm talking about whatever jurisdiction they cover. Do they get a lot of these, let's call it a murder, as I believe it is right now. Do they get a lot of these cases in the course of their year?
I can check stats on Santa Rosa very quickly, but I think they average maybe 3 to 5 a year, and that's a guess at most. And five would probably be
pretty bad.
You know, what
yeah,
I'm seeing here, this parallels some of my recent cases. And what I mean by that, there's two in particular that almost the same as this. We had a young man in a bar, just found out that he was going to be a father, went to the ATM machine in the bar, took out a lot of money out of the bar, bought drinks, winds up going outside around the corner, They find his body. There's railroad tracks around the corner. They find his body on the bottom of the hill leading to the railroad tracks. Medical examiner right away says he either fell, he was, you know, he had some liquor in him, either fell walking up the hill or falling down the hill. And they wanted to end it like that. Well, we kept pounding away at it, pounding away. We finally got, like I think Melody said before you, where we got it back to unknown and undetermined, where the police department is at least able to open up the case. But I'm seeing this more and more, where the medical examiner's offices and sometimes, on rare occasions, the police departments that just end a case. It's almost like you and me, David, in a room. We're the two investigating officers. We look at each other, and you say to me, "Ah, it looks like an accidental drowning to me." And I go, "You know, probably was." And we go home. Now, I'm sorry to make light of it. Now, that doesn't happen. That's not the norm. Let me say this. Most of the police departments across the country do stellar work, okay? Once in a while, though, and I'm starting to see more and more of this stuff, and this case really is more ridiculous than a lot of the ones I've done with the cell phone thing and everything else that we've talked about. You know, it doesn't make any sense that how you can say this is an accidental drowning. You got information from somebody saying, well, you know, somebody said to me they killed him or this or that or he was murdered. And, like, where is the top people that go out and really delve into this and really dig on this stuff? You know, it's not sitting well with me. You know, one other case just to show you the parallel again. Another young man dies, a drug type of a thing. The father had to actually read in the newspaper that the case was closed. Nobody even called him and told him that the case was closed. He read in the paper. Fortunately, a cop in that jurisdiction that the father went to school with whispered in his ear, don't let it go at that. Dig into it. And 4 years later, after he hired me and other people, and Dr. Michael Bodden was hired on the case and things like that, we finally got two arrests. 4 years later, but it's just not letting it go. See, we didn't let it go. They thought they were dealing with a family that they were able to say, well, we're sorry, Mr. So-and-so. You know, our apologies. That's the end of it. Goodbye. Thinking that they were going to go home and just disappear into oblivion, you know?
But exactly.
He started
people get caught in their grieving.
That's right. He started putting the team together. He hired me. I brought in the attorneys for him. We brought in Dr. Michael Bodden. That really added a lot to the case. And like I said, it took 4 years, which was ridiculous. But, you know, we wound up getting two arrests. Now, that obviously didn't bring his son back, but at least it's a part of justice and closure. You see?
Right.
And that's what I'm seeing on your case. Your name's Melody, right? Just like my daughter,
yes.
Melody.
Yes.
You know, and you just got to keep pounding away. It may take you a long time to do it, but you know, when you have a child, it's kind of this father would say to me, hey, I'm my son's voice.
I
do a little bit on his case, my son John can't do this, I have to do it for him. And,
right.
and that's what you're doing, Melody.
That's the biggest problem. I think people get stuck in their grieving and they're not looking ahead going, whoa, wait a minute, this is fishy, or whoa, wait a minute, that's not right. Set the grieving aside and start jumping in. You know, it's okay to grieve, but you got to be paying attention.
Right, right.
Yeah.
That's for sure. Yeah. And it's just amazing how these things, you know, just to tell you a story on this case I told you about with one of the people dying, the medical examiner's office who said that he fell going up the hill or down the hill. The father actually went to the medical examiner's office, met with the medical examiner, the one that performed the autopsy. The guy said to him at that time, you know, you want me to go in the room and change it? I can change it to make it undetermined or something like that. You want me to send it to you? And he said, I'll send it to you the next day or call me. By the time the next day when my father called them up, he already got yelled at, we heard, by the big boss, okay? And by that time, the guy said, no, I'm sorry, I can't change it for you. So, you know, your case, you know, we're in Connecticut, you're down there. It happens across the country. And the only way you get an answer is you got to keep going at it and going at it. And I think I heard you say before you had a rally or some kind of thing that you guys did. Now, you know, obviously, you see what happens. I could tell you as an ex-cop, and cops get mad. because they're saying, oh, mm-hmm. look, she's not going to give it up. Look at this now. Now she's got people here, and she's doing this and doing that. But you see, who cares? Because you have to go do what you have to do, you know? And mm-hmm. and that's the only way you're going to continue. And, you know, the only thing I could tell you, Melody, is be encouraged. You know, as a Christian guy, as I was listening to this before, I think about a scripture in 1 Corinthians chapter 4 that says, what is hidden in the dark will be brought into the light. Okay?
Absolutely.
And keep that, you know, if anything, I'm not trying to be corny with the listeners tonight, but just as a church-going guy, I want you to at least walk away from this show taking that verse and thinking about it. What is hidden in the dark, that means what somebody's trying to hide, will eventually be brought into the light. So, you know, just keep that in mind and dwell on mm-hmm. that and put your people together. And David, again, man, you're doing good stuff. I'm telling you, I am so impressed in listening to you. You know this case like the back of your hand, and that is great, my friend.
Well, you're very kind. I do want to give some credit to my wife, Kathy. We put about 1,000 hours into it, so she put at least half of those hours up front. And her insights were exceedingly helpful. But let me ask you a question, if I may, Vito, real quick.
Sure.
You know, very often the body of the deceased will speak and tell you what happened. You know, haven't you found that to be true in your career?
Mm-hmm.
Sure. On one of the cases that I told you about with Dr. Bobbin, he came in, and the time of death that the police had said was as soon as Dr. Bobbin started to look at autopsy pictures before he even did anything else, he said, no, I can tell you exactly when this happened, because when you take this kind of a drug and this and that, you start to go into this and you go into that, and it takes a while. I mean, and he totally changed the whole time of death and everything else, which mm-hmm. which gave us the insight to show who was there and what happened and kind of move on from that point. And, you know, it's amazing. Each case is separate, but sometimes they're so unique and almost the same in a lot of ways. You know, David?
Yeah.
And I'd like you to just help me, if you can shoot a hole through any of these theories. Was my statement true? Is it true that nature very rarely will offer symmetrical injuries on a body?
Yeah, I believe that is. I believe that is. I mean, you know, again, they're trying to say this is a drowning, okay? You have, from what I read on this case, there was very little water on the clothes. Am I right with that? Or you know, you got a cell phone. I lost a cell phone one time, or it dropped in a puddle of water, and it was gone. That was it. You know, I had to go buy another one. You look at it, you say, oh, boy. This mm-hmm. cell phone was in his pocket, right? Supposedly in water. You know, there's just so many things that, see, you wonder sometimes what the train of thought is when you have a police department. This one fella I told you about who went up to the medical examiner's office, as he sat there waiting for the medical examiner to come out, he told me a story. He looked out the window, and for an hour that he sat there, he saw vehicle after vehicle pulling bodies out. And it made him realize how many hundreds and hundreds of bodies come in and out of this place where the people have to do their autopsies and the whole bit. And a lot of times, what they do is they talk to the police. What do you think, Detective Smith? What do you think, Detective Jones? Well, you know, it looked, from everything we saw, it looked like he was drunk and he was near the train tracks, and he either fell walking up the hill or fell going down the hill. And the medical examiner already has that in their mind, and I'm not taking it away from the great medical examiners. Sometimes if they don't find or think they see anything else, they go with that. And we had to get that changed. And it shouldn't be that way.
I want to know, how do you find out, who do these guys answer to? You know, who's above them when you have questions? Because it's like one person making the ruling. It seems to me you have a second opinion.
Right. Who looks after the medical examiners?
Well,
who's
their
boss?
The ones that, see, there's usually a head medical examiner, at least most of the states that I know, okay? He's the head guy. There's different ones. There could be two. There could be five or six, depending on how big the state is, how many things of this nature. And they make the reports, goes to the police if need be, signed off by the head medical examiner or something of that nature. And that's it. I mean, you know, and then when you question it, because you know why? Because a lot of times people question things that are so, you know, out and out obvious. But then there's times like you, Melody, that has a legitimate thing, but yet they don't want to spend the time to be able to say, well, you know, they got a good point here. These things don't add up, you know? And that's the problem. Who they answer to in the long run, I don't know. I don't know if it goes any farther than the head boss there.
Real quick, one of the cases you mentioned you worked on, the deceased had been known to have a lot of money on him. This is the case with Joshua.
Yep.
He's one of the persons of interest stated to the police that he saw a large amount of cash in Joshua's wallet a little earlier in the day. A wallet which is believed to be Joshua's was found in the water, floating in the water the morning of his death, by one of the Santa Rosa Sheriff's deputies, and it was empty. It had nothing in it at all. And it certainly, I believe, one of the motives may have been robbery.
Right.
Usually, you know, when you got a wallet in your pocket and it has things in it like ID or pieces of paper, I mean, there's so many things tucked into so many different compartments. When your pants get wet, you know, presuming Joshua's jeans and these were former jeans were wet, usually the wallet's going to be less likely, not more likely to come out. But if it did come out, I can't imagine why all of the contents of it would almost miraculously and spontaneously disappear. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, see, when my guy was found on this on the crest of this hill, everybody had seen his friends and different people had seen him draw out about $600 from the ATM right in the bar. And as the night went out and he was celebrating it was going to be the birth of his child, he was pulling out the money out of his pocket. And in a little bit of an intoxicated state, he started holding the money, like, up even higher and higher as he was sitting at the bar. So everybody saw that. Here's my question, though, to the police at that time. His body is found. There's no wallet, and there's none of this money around. And, like, okay, well, sir, where did the money go? Where did the wallet go? If you're giving us all his property back except the wallet and the money, but you're saying he fell down and hit his head or whatever, where is everything? You see?
Did the wallet and the money accidentally drowned?
Yeah, I know.
I know.
As Joshua accidentally drowned, frankly.
Well, yeah. You know, Melody, a case like yours could be solved next week, or it could go another 2-3 years. The whole thing is to keep your strength up and to keep, maybe at the end of each day, say to yourself as you go to bed, all right, I feel I accomplished a little something today, a little something tomorrow, because that's the only way you're going to get through. Sometimes, unfortunately, you have to show people that you're not going to go away quietly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when it's not somebody's kid and they see dozens and dozens of these things on a weekly basis, they're kind of numb by it, okay? I can remember my days as a cop where I would just, get to a location, there'd be a dead body, and it would be kind of like just dead body watch till the undertaker got there, and family would come in from all over the town crying and screaming, oh, sorry, back away, please, go stand over there, you know, and you get numb to all this stuff, you see? But it's not their kid, it's your child, you see?
Right.
Mm-hmm. I have a question for Vito or anyone, David, Melody. It was cold and windy that day on the beach. David, didn't you say it was like 30 degrees or something? And that's cold.
That's real cold for Florida too.
It is.
That was that night. Yeah, that day.
And it was that night,
but,
right? But now they kept going. Josh and his friends kept going down these stairs and come under the building or under the stairs.
Correct.
And then they come back up and go into Juana's. Mm-hmm. Now Ricky was one of those people, and Davey and Chris. Do you think now, David, you had said that possibly the fight took place down the beach a ways. What makes you think it took place down the beach a ways rather than under the building?
Because the line on the sand that I see up to his body begins in a place which is down the beach a little bit and perpendicular to the beach itself, to the waterline. And there's a kind of a double oval shaped indentation on the beach visible at the head of the line, up in a more rocky and shelly type area of the beach where I believe the conflict took place. So it's that drag line which I believe indicates that.
Okay. Okay, and one other quick question, then Denny, I'll turn it over to you. When Davey said to you on the phone, "I know he was murdered," did you say, "Geez, why do you say that?" Or what was his reasoning for saying that? Or did he just say, "I don't know, I just feel it in my gut," probably, or something?
Well, that would seem like a natural response, but I didn't. I was, frankly, I first of all, at that time, I was certain that Ricky and Davey, in my mind, I was certain that they had something to do with Joshua's death. I believe, and I do believe now, it is my opinion, and I have a right to my opinion, that they were directly involved in murdering him, with the possible help of one or more other people, but I believe Ricky and Davey were there to the bottom of my soul. So I was rather shocked that he was calling me, and then secondarily, I thought that his tone of voice, being so lackadaisical and relaxed and almost friendly and humorous, was so out of place that I was having flashbacks to Police Academy, which I was in the early 90s, where they said, "What you want to watch out for is people that have improper emotions for the circumstance." Because that's going to indicate something, either mental illness or guilt or something. And I couldn't think of a more improper emotion than the one he was expressing, since I had just accused him of murdering Joshua. So I didn't have anything. I was just an observer. And at some point very early in his comments to me, I decided I didn't want to taint anything he said with really any response I had. I just simply wanted to hear what he had to say and take clear note of it. So, no,
right.
I didn't ask that.
Did anybody ever question the girl that Ricky had beat up, the one that he was serving time in prison for?
I don't think anybody's been questioned since all of this. Yeah,
Denny?
Yes. Thanks. Melody,
yes.
A few things I would like to ask you, if I may. First of all, I want to clarify something. You said you have a top-notch private investigative effort going on your behalf right now. Am I correct?
Yes.
And we all know that Vito's top-notch, but it's not Vito, right? I want to make clear that...
No, it's not Vito.
Okay. But this... the investigative effort that's ongoing on your behalf is something that you've done. It's nothing as a result of law enforcement or some resources through the government or anything. This is a private thing that you're doing?
Correct.
Okay. And Denny, yes.
If I could just say one thing along the line of that, I think in looking at this case, since this case, one of the positives we do have on this case is a list of some possible suspects in it, okay? And what I mean by that, that's going to wind up down the road or whenever breaking this case, because people will talk. People will talk when they're drunk. People will talk when they're out with their girlfriend or whatever we say in the Italian language, their gumas or something of that nature. So something's going to break along that line. And I think if the private detectives do their stuff and do it well, which I'm sure they will, eventually they'll get that one piece from somebody that's going to put it over the top.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, that's certainly encouraging. Yeah, you're right. Eventually, somebody's going to slip up. Somebody that knows something is going to say something and give it up. Melody, so the death certificate, we were talking about that, and one of your efforts is to get the classification changed to undetermined. Am I correct in
yes.
that?
Yes.
Okay.
Correct.
Now, we talked before... the difference as far as resources go, when you have the death ruled as an accident or a suicide, that closes a lot of doors, I believe you told me, to different resources, where if it's a homicide and you're the family of a crime victim, being a homicide, you have access to a lot more services and resources to help you in your efforts, but that accidental or suicide classification limits you. Am I correct in that
yes,
statement?
Yes, very, very correct. There's victims advocacy programs, too, I believe in every state. Could be every county. I'm not really sure how that works. But it's blocked. You can't get help. Usually they would help you with counseling or the funeral, lots of different things. And I haven't been able to get anything. I even asked the sheriff for help because of the wear and tear on my vehicle and loss of work, going back and forth to keep things moving and do the protest, et cetera. He didn't even respond to my request. Yeah, there's not a lot of help when it's ruled a certain way.
How do you go about getting those things changed?
I'm not sure. I think you put together a list of evidence and say, well, you know, this is what we believe, and request it. And then if they deny it, then I think media? I'm not really sure. I've never done this before. Mm. I'm learning as we go.
Yeah, yeah.
Vito, you you mentioned when you were talking about one of your cases that an assistant ME, I believe you said, had offered to change a death certificate. And
right.
He was going to do it by the next day or whatever. And apparently someone got to him, his boss, presumably, and that was all off the table. Is it somewhat common for this to happen?
Yeah, unfortunately, you're seeing it more and more across the country. Fortunately, then, as we kept pounding away and saying, hey, wait a minute, this guy said this and that. You know, you told my client you're going to do this now. Fortunately, then we got it back open, where then the police department, I made sure I got this on the front page of the local papers, where it was reopened and the whole bit, and because, you know, otherwise nobody's going to take a look at it. You know, I mean, you're out there as a private detective doing your work, but, you know, you want to have some people with the eager ears on the other end to hear what you're uncovering, and it's an open case, you know. But, you know, there's always a pride thing, too. You know, it's kind of like, you know, I told Mr. and Mrs. Smith how their son died. What the hell they keep calling here for every week and the same thing, and they're bugging us, and, you know, and it winds up getting that kind of a way. They want you to just believe and understand whatever they're saying, and as a parent you're saying, no, this doesn't sit right with me. I'm not going to just believe it. I want to look into this more and more. I'm going to hire this person, hire that person, and have an investigative reporter like David, and just you know, do what I have to do.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you this then, Vito. You take Melody's been very fortunate to find some help and some investigative help.
Yeah.
To work on her behalf. But when you take people, and I think there are a lot of them out there in similar situations to that of Melody, and they don't have the resources, and they aren't able to hook up with experts or professionals to help them pro bono, I mean, what do you do in those cases? If you can't get the expertise to work for you to
right.
To try to do this, you would throw your hands up and just say, hey, I'm beaten. I don't know where do you go if you don't,
well,
you don't have
see,
the resources?
The tough spot with that is, the tough thing with that, Denny, is that, okay, let's look at my office. I have four people that work for me, okay, besides myself, top-notch people. And if they were going to go and get involved in a case of this nature, see, I would be saying to the client, okay, I can't charge you pro bono, but here's what I'll do. I'll let you take Bob and Sue, who are excellent investigators, and instead of paying the full amount, you have to pay the money where at least they're getting paid what they would normally get paid, and I won't take my money. See, that's the best you're going to get on that. Now, if you have a one-man operation or a two-man operation that are willing to take that time off and to, you know, to go to Florida and not be hurt financially by saying, okay, Melody, look, here's what we'll do. The next 2 weeks will work. Don't worry about it. Pay me a little bit with expense. Pay me whatever you can afford to pay me, and we'll delve into it for 2 weeks before we have to go back home and get back in our work. See, that's the problem with it, because you know, the investigators have to get their salary somehow, and even if you're having one of your best people work it, you still got to pay for that person, you see?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Unless you have an availability of somebody that says, I'll give you a month for free. I'll come there and I'll do it for free. See, that's the whole problem with something of this nature, you know?
Mm-hmm. It is very
yeah.
hard. Can I add to that real quick? What happened with me is I looked to the creator.
Yep.
I didn't look at the circumstances. And I kept trusting him, and along the way, he keeps putting people in my path that have been so kind to help, you guys included. But that's how I did it. I looked to the Creator, and I just trusted him.
That's good. I think that's excellent, Melody. And I think in the long run, you'll see a good result if you just believe on that. I mean,
yes.
Most cases of this nature, I'll be very honest with you, you don't have an investigative reporter like David that's pounding away on this, putting 1,000 hours in on a case like this. The reporters I deal with will get involved, and it's kind of like, all right, Vito, call me when you have a new lead. I'll put it in the paper. That's all you'll usually get, you know. It's like, and I'll call them because the family will say, hey, you know, get this in the paper that we found a wallet, or we found this, or we found that. And at least it gets it fresh out in the public. But, you know, here you got a guy that's constantly trying to do things and get it out there and talking to people, and the cops are probably mad at him, but who cares, you know.
Everybody that's helped, Dr. Berkland, Denny, all of the different people, you know, the different Susan Milano Murphy, all the different people that have helped, they've just been exceptionally the best, have been put in my path. I am a blessed person. But that's
wonderful.
How it happened.
Am I still with us? Let me suggest how this murder is going to be solved. You're very kind, Vito. But to be completely frank, I haven't done very much with this case for many months. This has kind of been a reawakening for me. I looked at all my materials again. And I think that perseverance, which you referred to earlier, is going to be the key. The fact that the family is in the right, that Joshua was in fact murdered, and perseverance will bring about revelations. I am certain there will be revelations on the horizon. And I think essentially we need to keep pounding the police agency responsible for investigating this event with the facts. You have to
keep pounding
the medical examiner with the facts.
I think you're absolutely right, David, but unfortunately, Denny and everyone, the lights are flickering, so that means we've got to sign off, means that you didn't pay the electric bill. I'm not sure which, but yeah, go ahead, Denny.
There's just one quick thing. I just want to tell everybody what I'd like to do, Kim, if you agree, we'll discuss it right now. Is down the road a little bit when Melody gets some more information. She has some things in the oven. I'd like to have her back on to update us, especially if there's a break in the case.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you,
Melody, because even the folks in the chat room are asking that please have everyone back again. And next week, first of all, I want to thank you, Melody. My prayers, our prayers are with you. Vito Colucci, Jr., thank you so much for the private investigator extraordinaire. Thank you for being with us. And David Craig, God bless you and the work you do. And that's David of Reality, Craig of Reality News Network. Denny, thank you. I thank our guests for listening. And I want to just say on August 11th, we will have Dr. Scott LaPointe, who is the deputy medical examiner with Monroe County in New York, and William B. Sullivan, who is the owner of Forensic Consulting Specialties. And now Melody would like to end the program with a poem that she would like to share with everyone. Go ahead, Melody.
This is called Miss Me, But Let Me Go. When I come to the end of the road and the sun has set for me, I want no rights in a gloom-filled room. Why cry for a soul set free? Miss me a little, but not too long, and not with your head bowed low. Remember the love that we once shared. Miss me, but let me go. For this is a journey we all must take, and each must go alone. It's all a part of the Master's plan, a step on the road to home. When you are lonely and sick of heart, go to the friends we know, and bury your sorrows in doing good deeds. Miss me, but let me go.
Very nice, Melody. God bless you.
Thank you. Same to you guys. Thank you. And thank you to everybody
you.
Who has helped.
Thank you, Melody. Good night and God
Bye.
Bless.
Same
good
to
night.
You guys. Bye.